Hi. Say hello. Good morning. My name is Laurel Toby. I'm the founder of MediaBistro.com and a new startup called Biltboard. I'm here to introduce Steve. This talk, my introduction will take about 40 minutes. No, I'm kidding. Steve Rosenbaum is an author, entrepreneur, blogger, curator, and connector. He's probably best known as the man in the giant backpack. He walks around with this big, giant backpack, I swear to God. I always see him around town at different events wearing his backpack. So I wore one just to show you what it looks like. Steve's book, Curation Nation, he argues the current path of digital content curation is a recipe for disaster. Interviewing 70 of the leading thinkers in media, publishing, and advertising, Rosenbaum makes the compelling case that the future of the web is curated, not created. And if history is any judge, he's a pretty good predictor of things. He's also the CEO of the largest video curation platform, Magnify.net. He provides a real-time curation solution that powers more than 86,000 sites, including Patagonia, New York Magazine, TEDx, and many, many more. Rosenbaum was also named New York City's first entrepreneur at large for economic development at in 2011. God knows what that means, entrepreneur at large. Any of you have a clue? Tell me, please. Before email or the web, Rosenbaum created MTV's groundbreaking user-generated series, MTV Unfiltered. This was a pre-web television project that handed cameras out to young storytellers. It was really, really, really well received. Since that time, he's built a career finding, organizing, and contextualizing stories. Please give a warm welcome to Steve Rosenbaum. Thank you.
So I'm going to be over here in this little corner right here because we've got a lot of things to show you on the screen. Thank you, Laurel. That was a lovely introduction. And by the way, I have my backpack. I will wear it later. And I keep waiting for the stuff in it to get smaller, so I don't need to have such a big backpack. So I think we're going to have some fun in the next hour. We're going to explore a topic that is conceivably a little scary and take you to some places you may not want to go, and then hopefully come out the other side with a happy ending. Did I just say that? Sorry. The cloud is thought of as this warm, wonderful thing, fluffy, endlessly charming. You know, theoretically, as all the information on the web continues to grow, our hard drives floodeth over, and the cloud comes in and rescues us, right? That's the good side of the story. But when I began my journey reporting Curation Nation, which is now 2 years ago, the one thing that I started to get scared by was the volume of stuff being created was exceeding any of the measures that anybody anticipated. And we're going to show you some data later to back that up, some of which is new. So what I found myself thinking is, what happens when we really all get to digital overload? And does the cloud solve that? Now, the cloud isn't public, and it isn't free, and it isn't even really fully formed. So the question in this talk that I'm going to ask is, what if the cloud isn't what we want it to be? What if it's dark and stormy rather than white and fluffy? And what can we do to protect the open web? So let's start with something that we all think of when we think of totalitarianism and Uber control. And by that I mean traffic lights. Right? Okay, maybe I lost you. Traffic lights are a little confusing, and let me explain where this thesis comes from. I want to take you back to a prescient piece of filmmaking, an extraordinary piece of clip from the Sarah Connor Chronicles that'll explain. Here, take a look.
Jessica Peck was a lobbyist being paid to oppose ARTI.
Who's ARTI?
Automated Real-Time Traffic Information Exchange.
So this is about traffic lights.
Exactly. It's a fiber optic network linking every street intersection to a data center in City Hall. Cameras, microphones, sensors.
Traffic. It's not about traffic, it's about information. Eyes and ears everywhere. A system that can watch you, track you everywhere you go. If the Turk is destined to become Skynet's brain, this software could be its nervous system.
Like a body waiting for its head.
Of course. Traffic lights. Very scary. But you get the point. I love this series, by the way, and if you haven't watched it, it's worth a... I don't know how you get it anymore. I guess it's going to say Netflix, maybe. So let's go back to the beginning of the web. Now, isn't this a great picture? I mean, look at Mark Andreessen looking all collegey and like he's probably in sweats. Well, the truth of the matter is, sidebar, I actually have a very funny story about this picture. In 1993, I was just beginning to produce a series for MTV called Unfiltered, and I was invited to go out to the University of Champaign-Urbana to speak to a journalism class. And after the class, the professor said to me, "Would you like to go and see our computer lab?" And I said, "Sure." And I went into this decrepit old building on the campus, and there, sitting in flip-flops and shorts and a t-shirt, was Andreessen, who showed me one of the very first incarnations of Mosaic. And, you know, over the course of the next couple of days here at South By, you're going to see a lot of things. And if you're lucky, you'll see something like Twitter that makes you go, okay, this changes everything. And for me, that moment looking at Mosaic, it was like so clear. It was an explosion in front of me, and I saw the future because it was so clear that it changed the way people communicated and the way they shared, and the public web kind of laid out in front of Mosaic. It was really actually very exciting to have an opportunity to glimpse the future back in 1993, which seems like a very long time ago now. But I digress. It was magical because it wasn't any one place. It wasn't a server or a company or a business model. It was a mess. It was a glorious, complicated, crazy collection of servers and points of presence and colleges and hackers. But hold on. I'm going to press pause. Now, I'm many things. I'm a writer and I'm a curator and I'm a filmmaker. But I'm not trained as a historian, and I'm certainly not trained as a futurist. So as I began to put this talk together, I was able to lay out a very clear pattern for where I thought the dangers of the open web were and where the cloud kind of played a role. But I became concerned that to ask you to sit for an hour and listen to my vision of the future when there were so many people that had really been at the beginning of the web was being a little bit disrespectful. Now, what I wanted to do was put together a panel of genius experts. But as I said, I'm a curator and a filmmaker, so I did something a little different, and I hope you appreciate it. I put together instead a virtual panel. It would be called a Greek chorus, but since we're here at South By, I will coin the term geek chorus. So over the course of this talk, from time to time, we'll invite the geek chorus to participate in this talk. And just to be clear, these are not videos that have floated around the web. These are interviews that I did last week with these three esteemed individuals. And let me just take a moment to introduce them. So first, as we introduce the geek chorus, our first panelist is Tim Berners-Lee, extraordinary individual, thinker, and seer. And I'll let him introduce himself.
Tim Berners-Lee, I invented the web way back in 1989. I've been working to keep it open and with open standards with the World Wide Web Consortium for since 1994. I'm involved in too many things, I have very many hands, but almost all of them rely on this medium being kept, being open and neutral and available to everybody.
So we're going to get more from Tim about the openness of the web and its relative danger. I posed the question to him. I told him we would be at South By and he'd be presenting in front of a group of digital thinkers. And I said, should we be concerned about the future of the web? And here's what he had to say.
If you are concerned that, and you should be concerned, that the fact that the internet is something which is available openly to everybody, may be under threat, then get together with other people and make sure that you protest until it's fixed. Every time some large company or some large government breaks it.
So for those of you taking notes at home, you should be concerned, Tim Berners-Lee. I mean, I watched that four times to make sure that he wasn't being casual about it, and we'll hear a little more from him later. So our next virtual panelist is Tim O'Reilly, probably well known to this audience. Coined the term Web 2.0, is the voice and energy behind a lot of the maker movement, extraordinary individual, and I invited him to participate in our virtual panel as well. So I asked him this question, does the danger of the open web concern you? And here's what he had to say.
So, you know, there was the first, you know, wave of the closed web is the dominance of companies like Google and Facebook, you know, the networks they build, increasing returns in their networks. And then, of course, there's this new attack in sort of closed hardware, sort of bringing it around. So there's always a threat to the open web. But the other side of that is that the sort of the impulse to openness and innovation will reassert itself somewhere else.
And our last panelist is Juan Enriquez. Now, Juan is an extraordinary bioscientist and innovator and doing all kinds of interesting work. But the reason that I wanted to bring him here today is he wrote this book called The Untied States of America. And, you know, it's a tough Google search because it comes up as everyone wants to correct it to United States of America. But in fact, the quote from this book that has me thinking about this conversation today is the fact that there has yet to be a U.S. president that has been buried under the same flag he was born under. And that's one of those things you have to kind of roll around in your brain for a second. But the point of the book is to say things change. Just because we look at the web today and expect it to behave the way it does, and we wake up in the morning and it's the same as yesterday or the day before, doesn't mean we shouldn't stand back and say, the web is not that old. The idea that it is free and open is not a foregone conclusion. And in fact, there are some things going on that we're going to talk about that really should raise your eyebrows and make you think there's a direction it's going in that we need to have an impact on. So, I asked Juan to participate, and the question that I asked him was, you know, if we are just using the web blithely, if we're not paying attention to how it behaves, should we be concerned? And here's what he had to say.
Almost nobody reads those agreements, and some of those agreements have a whole pile of things in them that you kind of go, are you kidding me? Like, who owns this? Who's got the right to use it? How long can you keep it? And those are things which are, you know, really serious issues, and I think we're going to have redefinitions of privacy.
So, let's just lay out how much things have changed and why we're paying attention to the cloud now. This is what we've been going through. This is the fundamental growth in the way in which the web has evolved over a period of time. And you know, it goes back to 1946 when we had the first general purpose computer. You all know this. By 1965, we had Moore's Law. And then flashing forward, today we have Walmart, which is handling 1 million customer transactions every hour. So this is to tie back to the Juan Enriquez quote, which is simply saying things are changing dramatically and quickly, and they're not going to remain the same. Some of these facts you need to kind of put in perspective, because just by way of example, how many people here today, well, this is a little quick quiz of the audience, how many people here today, before you had your first cup of coffee, checked your email this morning? Okay, so that's essentially 100%. How many of you, the last thing you do at the end of the day after you've put the kids to bed and walked the dog and shut off the TV and fed the fish and done all that stuff, the last thing you do is check your email? Okay, so I've never had that be 100% before. It's really frightening. Extra credit question. How many of you in the last 3 weeks, at least once, have woken up in the middle of the night to check your email? Okay, so that's fucked up. Like, that's not a healthy thing. Your mother would be upset with you. You know, so what are we all doing, right? We're scrambling to keep track of this massive growth in information with the sense that if we keep struggling to bail water out of this thing, eventually the onslaught will stop. Well, there's some data to prove that that's not the case. You know, this won't surprise you. 250 million photos are being uploaded to Facebook every day. 80 Eiffel Towers worth, stacked as flat paper. 864,000 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every day. That's 98 years of content every day. So by the way, for those of you who are consultants, when your clients tell you that they want your video to go viral, remind them that you're putting that video in a pool of 98 hour years of content every day. And then last but not least, email. And if you're wondering why it's impossible to get through your inbox, and we now all are struggling to do that, this is the answer. If the U.S. Postal Service had to manage this much mail, one day's worth of letters would take them 2 years. So this has all been happening since the last time we saw each other at South by Southwest. I mean, this continues to go up and to the right rather dramatically with no slowing in sight. And then last but not least, the big player in this space that we need to pay attention to is the government, which maybe isn't the place where you think about the most data being created, but the reality is the government is creating an enormous amount of data every day. data about citizens, data about birth records and death records and electrical usage and car registrations and any number of things. And it's somewhat invisible, the amount of data the government creates, but they are the largest creator of raw data. And that, when you put it up against the question of the open web, is worth thinking about as well. So this all brings us to this idea that has become very popular, really almost since the last time we were together, which is big data. And I have to tell you, I'm puzzled by that word, because when you put big in front of anything, generally speaking, people don't go, oh, that's good, like big government or big brother, right? These aren't words that you go, oh, big brother's here, excellent. But big data is being presented as if it's only a positive thing. Big data is awesome. I think when you look at some of the data we're going to look at, that big data is a little bit scary. So, you know, one of the questions is, you know, how do people make sense of all this data? And this is Alex, I never pronounce his last name right, Salasky, Salay, something like that. And he asked the question, you know, we should be worried about how we train the next generation, not just scientists, but people in government and industry. And you're going to hear this word worried a lot. Joel Hellerstein says, we're at the industrial revolution of data. And last but not least, Craig Mundy says, we're seeing the ability to have economies form around data. And that's a big change in the societal and even macroeconomic level. So we're talking about data as literally an organizing principle around businesses. So a little bit more kind of data about data, if you will. There are 4.6 million mobile phone subscriptions worldwide. The amount of digital information is increasing tenfold every 5 years. By 2013, the amount of traffic flowing over the internet will annually reach 667 exabytes. And this is maybe the important thing. Just 5% of this information is structured. The rest is like photos and videos, which are less retrievable and less organized. And the reason why that's important is when you go and try and manage your inbox or your social networks or any of these things that generally are creating the growth in the web, the fact that it is unstructured and that it's uncategorized and it's noisy makes it incredibly difficult to manage. And I thought this would be a good place to actually give you an example of how unstructured data looks and why it's hurting your head. So I picked the topic. How many of you in the room today are on the paleo diet? Anyone on the paleo diet? Excellent. Okay. The paleo diet is also known as the caveman diet. Yes, it's reasonably sexist. It's probably also the cavewoman diet. But for all intents and purposes, it suggests that you should eat what the cavemen eat. And so if some of you decided today, hey, this guy Rosenbaum's kind of entertaining, and he mentioned the paleo diet, so I'm going to go and research it and see what the paleo diet is, here's what you'd find. So I'm just going to go ahead and click, and we're going to go to YouTube. We could go to Google as well, but I think for the purposes of this presentation, this will make more sense. Paleo diet. Okay. So here's a whole bunch of videos. Eat like a caveman. So there's lots of paleo diet videos. There's a TED talk, TEDx talk. So I'm actually going to try and give this solution the benefit of the doubt and look for a channel that looks like it. So here's Paleo Caveman Diet channel. So let's assume that they've actually done a better job of organizing the material. So this is still relatively unstructured data. I mean, it has the keyword paleo diet, and it has a handful of videos. But without playing one, I'm pretty sure that I can tell you confidently that you're not going to get a good you're going to get an unfiltered result. You're going to get a result of the videos that are the most popular, but popularity in this case may not be what you want. You may not want the most dramatic video. You may want the most accurate one. So let me just give you an example of how big data works when you add curation on top of it. So let's take the paleo diet, and let's take a dollop of actual human beings and put it on top. So now we've got the paleo diet as a channel. And if you scroll down, you see that it's been baked into categories. There's recipes, there's fitness, there's testimonials, and here's members of this community who've actually organized around the paleo diet. And let's just go ahead and watch testimonials for a second. So These are all paleo diet users who could tell you about why it's so awesome. So my point here is simply being, let's just make that a little small. There we go.
Hi, my name is OG, and I just wanted to send in this short video to share my experience with the paleo recipe book because I love it. My goal this year was really...
Cavewoman, as I pointed out. So what I argued in Curation Nation and what is turning out to be true is at the end of the day, if data continues to grow exponentially and unmanageably as uncategorized raw data, and you take humans like us and put it on top of that and say, I volunteer to be the organizer of all of the proper information around this subject, which, by the way, it's interesting, nobody in the room, I expected a couple of paleo diet users. I guess maybe it's slightly earlier than I knew. But some of you will, if you had the choice between going to Google or YouTube, typing in paleo diet, having to kind of curate on your own with no knowledge of the space, or go to an existing community, find people who are already in it, find material that's been organized around that subject, that tends to be the way big data is going to move. So let's jump back to the presentation. Paleo diet, back in your cage. Come on. Okay. So we've arrived at a moment where a handful of companies provide core elements of what we think of as the web. Tim O'Reilly sees open source as being the indisputable in terms of pointing to things like TCP/IP, SendMail, Apache, Perl, Linux, and other open source platforms. So we asked him kind of flat out, does that mean that open source is in danger? And here's what he had to say. Oops. Excuse me.
I don't really mind having my data in Google's ecosystem, frankly. So I'm not the right guy to ask for that. It's funny, I do mind having my data in Apple's ecosystem. I tend to think Google gets a lot of shit because everybody was afraid of them as they were seen as the natural successor to Microsoft. But I think they really do have their heart in the right place. Yes, they sometimes get it wrong and they're capturing too much value for themselves and creating less of it than they used to. But they really are trying to do the right thing overall. I'm happy at this point to be in the Google ecosystem.
What about Facebook?
Facebook, I'm a little less happy with. Apple, I think Apple would rule us all with an iron fist if they could. If they had one ring to rule them all, they'd be quite thrilled with it.
Yeah. So by the way, his phone just stopped working at that moment. So we're at the crux of the matter. In the open web, there's no central cloud of data. There's no single point of failure. And while you can debate how Tim stacks up the various companies, the fact is the web has shifted from a mess of little servers to a handful of big ones. So the cloud, or the clouds, if you will, are the current place where all our data lives. And that simply is a fact today. So we went to Tim Berners-Lee, who jovially talks about inventing the web, and we said to him, where does the cloud fit into your vision of the web?
People mean different things by the cloud. Yeah. Typically, they mean services which are out there, which are managed for you by other people. So you don't have to worry about where you're storing the data, or you don't have to worry about where your program runs, and things like that. Obviously, when you put things in the cloud, if you store your photographs somewhere in the web, then as you do that, you're putting more trust into other companies. You're putting things out there, which, if they're subpoenaed, can be taken by the court system, taken by the governments. You're putting things out there in a way that oppressive regimes can then find them. So whereas people move things to the cloud, then it adds another level of threat, I suppose, yes. But don't forget the basic levels of threat which we have about spying on and censoring general access to the web.
So let's put to the side for just a moment governments and oppressive regimes. We'll get there. But first, I want to just let Juan Enriquez jump in. Oops. Come on.
So the cloud is a great thing in terms of memory and efficiency. It's cheap, it's easy, it's accessible anywhere. If it's a good cloud, it's backed up. But of course, it may be vulnerable. It may be that you could have leaks, as you've had with financial information, with a whole series of things. There's a potential for a systemic disaster in the measure that a lot of the cloud concentrates in very few companies.
So I just want to point out, when the guy that helped decode the genome talks about systemic disaster, like, that makes me want to pay attention. And this gets back to the original comment he made about the fact that the world changes while we're not paying attention. So I want to now get into some examples of things that have happened in the last year that you may have all treated as individual news stories, or maybe you were involved in some of them, but I don't know that you've necessarily knit them together into a pattern, and I'm going to try and do that for you in the next few minutes. Rebecca McKinnon wrote a terrific book. If you haven't picked it up yet, it's really awesome. And I'm just going to read you the quote that I think is meaningful for this talk. She said, "Politicians throughout the democratic world are pushing for stronger censorship and surveillance by internet companies to stop the theft of intellectual property. They're doing this so in response to aggressive lobbying by powerful corporate constituents without adequately considering the consequences for civil liberties and for democracy more broadly." That's not light copy. And let's begin with one that we all know. So let's talk about WikiLeaks. So the U.S. Justice Department opened a criminal probe into WikiLeaks and founder Julian Assange shortly after the leak of diplomatic cables began. And Attorney General Eric Holder confirmed the probe was, quote, not saber-rattling, but was an active, ongoing criminal investigation. And note that word. It's important. Criminal. Now, the Washington Post has reported that his department was considering charges under the Espionage Act, a move that former prosecutors characterized as difficult because the First Amendment protects the press. Several Supreme Court cases have previously established that American Constitution protects the republication of illegally gained information, provided the publishers did not directly break any laws by acquiring it. So federal prosecutors then considered prosecuting Assange for trafficking in stolen government property. But since the diplomatic cables are intellectual rather than physical property, that approach also faced hurdles. And then finally, any prosecution of Assange would require extraditing him to the United States, a step made more complicated and potentially delayed by any preceding extradition to Sweden. So the idea that we're using the word criminal as it has to do with the way people behave on the web is a new idea. And I would challenge you to think of examples before WikiLeaks of the federal government talking about that data being distributed in a criminal manner. Now, having said that, you could look at WikiLeaks as a standalone conversation for an entirely different panel. But again, I'm trying to build a case here. So let's just put a checkbox next to WikiLeaks, and then we'll move forward a little bit. Let's talk about SOPA. Now, as opposed to WikiLeaks, it's very easy to feel like SOPA was a massive success. I presume that some of the people in this room were actively involved in fighting that battle, and to those of you I say, congratulations, good job. But it may be that it's the beginning of a conversation, not the end. So there's a new generation that's responsible for that victory, and basically what happened is after months of rallying activists of all stripes, including liberals, conservatives, technology companies, free software activists, the protests against SOPA and PIPA achieved critical mass, and I think we probably all remember that day. With the support of traditionally non-activist Wikipedia, the internet community staged a powerful and effective shutdown of critical parts of the web, awakening millions to the fight that had been brewing for almost a year. That fight didn't try and affirm any right to pirate anyone's work. Instead, the anger in this battle was about extremism of Hollywood's response. It was fair and true to say the statute would have affected a kind of censorship unknown in the history of the internet, and at least in the United States, It was, in fact, a critical motivation to fight it. So put those two side by side. We've got WikiLeaks, which is an individual, and you can say what you will about Assange, and it's a complicated character. And then you can look at SOPA and PIPA and say, well, we all did the right thing. We saw that this thing was coming at us. We stopped it. Hooray. There's only one problem with that. Legal experts suggest that content creators should seek out new revenue streams that take advantage of the web's diverse distribution platforms rather than attempt to limit the exchange of content online. The ones who figure out that they're ready to team up and think outside of old world paradigms are the ones that are going to make it, says Tarleton Giuseppe, an associate professor from Cornell. So with the suspension of the SOPA and PIPA bills, the latest story in the federal government's war on internet privacy was the shutdown of the file sharing site Mega Upload. Now, what's ironic about the Mega Upload story is that it literally happened the day after SOPA and PIPA, like literally the next morning. Federal government off of U.S. soil, armed paramilitary troops. I mean, the other night I watched an interview that was the first interview that Kim.com did in which she talked about what happened. And I have to say, as the person that runs a web services company, you know, I wasn't terribly sympathetic to him in the past. And then I listened to what he said. And he said, you know, we had all these attorneys. We understood how the Digital Millennium Copyright Act worked. We had gotten no takedown notices. We believe we were operating within the law. And then we find that all four of the founders of this company are literally manacled and taken away in handcuffs. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm, you know, there's some history about, you know, if they don't knock on your door, don't say anything, right? I mean, I have videos on a server. I have 90,000 sites on my network. I guarantee you some of them have material that shouldn't be there. We respond to takedown notices promptly. We don't explicitly invite people to put up copyrighted work, which you could argue that Mega Upload did. But if you read the law, and I'm not a lawyer, so, but I did read the law, there's no distinction between the way I work and the way I operate in terms of the way the law views me and the way Mega Upload works. And I really don't want a helicopter to land outside my office and come with dogs and guns. So let's put these three together now. We started with, you know, way back in the early days, Julian Assange, what was that, 18 months ago? And then we went to PIPA and SOPA, great success. And then the next day, we have the shutdown of Mega Upload. Now, here's the thing about the shutdown of Mega Upload. It was shut down with this icon across its website. And I kind of thought it was like a joke at first, because it looked kind of like, really? And then I went and I looked at this. Does anyone know what this is? The Intellectual Property Rights Coordination Center? This is a federal government institution. I've since done a whole bunch of research. I still can't figure out what it is or where it comes from or where it got built. So we're all sitting here patting ourselves on the back saying SOPA and PIPA got shut down. And meanwhile, the federal government is now actively arresting owners of websites for piracy. And the thing that scares me is some number of people had their legitimate files stored on Mega Upload. They didn't know that they literally were putting their family's photographs up there. The next day, the federal government comes in, shuts down the site, the servers are gone, all that material is gone. That's the cloud, folks. That's the thing that we're kind of blithely thinking of as this great big white fluffy place that will forever store our family pictures. And the reality is, that's just not the way it's gonna go, at least not without some engagement on our part. So I wanna just tell you the story of the Mega Upload story in 2 minutes or less, because you've all heard it in bits and pieces, but I think you'll be interested in hearing some detail. So, acting upon a U.S. federal prosecutor's request, the New Zealand police arrested Kim.com and three of the other Mega Upload executives in at least $30 million luxury mansion in Coatesville, near Auckland, on Friday, January 20th. This was pursuant to the request of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation that all four be extradited. The raid was timed for the birthday of .com, and assets worth $17 million, including artworks, luxury cars, were seized. The four men arrested were Kim.com, Finn Bateo, Matthias Ortman, and Bram Vanderkolt. On January 23rd, .com appeared in Auckland's North Shore District Court at a bail hearing. The Crown argued that the bail against bail on the argument that he was a flight risk with a helicopter on his front lawn. Okay, I get that. Defense argued the helicopter could not fly far enough to reach another country. They also argued that .com denied any criminal wrongdoing. Judge David McNaughton expressed concern at the discovery hearings that two shotguns were found in .com's mansion. The judge deferred the decision to grant bail, saying he needed more time. The bail request was turned down. On February 3rd, an appeal court, the High Court of New Zealand, upheld the decision to deny bail. The site was shut down by IPR, the Intellectual Property Rights Center. I'm just curious, we can talk about this offline. Does anybody actually know what that is? One person. Excellent. We will talk after. Okay. So on February 22nd, the North Shore District Court Judge Neville Dawson overturned the previous rulings and granted bail to Kim.com, saying his risk of flight had diminished after his assets had been seized. He no longer had the helicopter. On March 5th, 2012, a formal request of extradition to the United States of Kim.com and three other senior Mega Upload staff was filed in New Zealand court. So maybe the arrest of .com and the shutdown of Mega Upload and its sister site, Mega Video, are proof that the U.S. government may not need SOAP or PIPR to protect copyrights. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, enacted in 1998, gives lawmakers the authority to remove the presence of illegally posted content without going so far as shutting down the site itself. This was due in large part to the fact that the site had advertised that it had illegal content. Now, even though the site was based in China, its .com name still meant that it fell under U.S. jurisdiction. SOPA, however, would allow lawmakers to venture further, shutting down U.S. access to foreign domains, as well as domains falling under U.S. jurisdiction. So, the Mega Upload saga is definitely a cautionary tale. It's a tale about cloud file storage and about the relationship between the web and the government. It's also a definite bummer for people who have used it to share copyrighted material. But it's even a bigger letdown for users who use the service to store personal files. So, back to our friends at the Geek Chorus. What does Tim Berners-Lee think about this trend?
In fact, what is determining, what is driving the government, unfortunately, is the lobby of the people who are worried about teenagers stealing music. Now, the web is a lot more than teenagers keep stealing music. And if we set up the whole, all the legal system around it, so as to make sure that this horrible thing that a teenager might steal some music doesn't happen at all, and make sure that people can be cut off very quickly without a trial from using the internet, for example, then we end up giving governments in general the power to be able to abuse the internet. And when you give a government the ability to abuse the internet, to be able to cut somebody off or spy on what they're doing, then that means that governments in general, not just this government, which you may support, but future general governments which you may not support, or governments in oppressive countries which have already demonstrated to be very abusive of their citizens, once you allow governments that to take that power, then that will be abused.
So I like that quote, and I think he's entirely right. I think all the laws that we're looking at today are about teenagers stealing music or movies. Right? That's the thesis: is piracy is so terrible that we have to enact all of these. We have to give the government all these powers to manage the web, and we then have to take all of our data and put it in a handful of servers and give the government permission to actually turn them up and down. Back to our friend Juan Enriquez. This is going in a direction, kids. I mean, it truly is, and it's worth paying attention to. So I asked, this is something that I think is very important. So John Battelle, who I think is a terrific thinker, you know, had to post on his blog, and he said, if we lose the web, we lose way more than funny cat videos and the occasionally brilliant blog posts. We lose the commons. We lose an ecosystem. We lose a place where serendipity, dirt, iterative trial and error, and drive open innovation. And that is why we're all here, right? We're not here to trade music files. We're here to innovate. We're here, and the web that we're here to celebrate in the next couple of days is fundamentally built on freedom. So what do we do? Now, I'm not wise enough to answer this question. I'm going to give you a couple of thoughts in a minute, but the first thing I want to do is let Tim Berners-Lee talk about what do we do about this challenge of openness.
I think that we'll look back. We will millions of people who are really passionate about this will make sure that the web is somewhere where a human being can be a human being and a group of people can be a group of people. If you look at society, it has the big open public, which is amazing. The public has the public domain, but it also has organizations and, you know, companies. When companies operate, they need to be able to operate as an enterprise. They have to be able to keep their internal operations to a certain extent separate, secret from their competitors. That makes them a company. If you have a family has to be able to keep its internal operations secret from other people in order to function as a family. So if you respect a family, you respect the privacy that a family has. If you respect a couple that love each other, they have things that they want to share just between themselves. Very often nowadays, couples that love each other, they're separated, they communicate using the internet. You respect the love that two people have, then you respect them by not, by giving them a space where they're not spied on. If you respect an individual, I have stuff that I don't want to share with anybody else. So if you respect an individual, if you respect human beings, then you must have a space in which people can have their own personal information, their own personal data, their own personal medical things, their own thoughts, their own journal, their own diary. So the world is this some nested set of overlapping groups. All of these groups have their own needs to be able to protect what happens to the data that they have, what happens to the photographs and the ideas. I think it's really important we build a socially aware web, where that's respectful of groups and respectful of people.
So, I just came back from a conference last week, and the folks at Mozilla released something called Collusion. Some of you may have heard of it. Collusion's really interesting. Collusion essentially, part of, I think, what we do to take control of the web that we want to have and that we want to have work in a certain way, is we begin to insist that we can actually see the way the web's behaving. And we don't let things happen behind closed doors. So I'm just going to go ahead and show you a little clip about Collusion.
There was a presentation at TED this year in 2012 where the CEO of Mozilla was showing just how many people are watching exactly what you're doing on the web and what your kids are doing on the web. And it's not just the ones you've said yes to. For everyone you've said yes to, there's 5 or 10 or 15 different things that are watching your clicks, that are watching your moves, that are watching your habits. And those things become electronic breadcrumbs and tracers of who and what you are and what you've been doing.
So if you haven't installed it and you use Firefox, you should. It's fascinating. And they're also here at the show, and you should get to, but what it really begins to do is for individuals to take back some understanding of the way the web's behaving. And so in the next few minutes, I want to give you some very specific, hands-on things that I think we can, you know, I don't believe that we're going off a cliff. I really don't. I'm not a pessimist. I believe that the web is fundamentally in a good place, but if we don't manage our relationship to it, and we don't, if we sit on our laurels and say, SOPA and PIPA, high five, we won, we all go back to, you know, posting and not paying attention, I think things are moving in a direction. And so I'm going to give you some very specific things that I think we can all do to effect change. And I want to start with a post that Robert Scoble put up, which I thought was actually very astute. You know, I'm not one of these people that preaches that we should, you know, shut off our web browsers and we should put our phones away and we should all sit around the fireplace at home and, you know, play Parcheesi with our kids. I don't believe that the way we're going to engage the digital web is by tuning out or dialing it down. In fact, I don't believe that at all. I do think that his suggestions are good ones, which is you don't delete your Facebook account. You don't say, you know, I'm going to respond to these challenges by opting out of things. What you do is you look to make as much of the information as you're comfortable public. You actually, you encourage mass openness as opposed to closed clouds. And then we begin to understand that really our data should be interoperable. I mean, you know, if you've ever tried to export your data from Facebook, you know, good luck with that. It's very hard to do. You've got companies that are building closed ecosystems. Now, they're doing that because none of their customers are insisting they do something different. I would argue that we own our data, and you can begin to say to the places where you store it, I want to be able to make my data portable, and I'm going to use a variety of different solutions. I'm not going to use one company to provide all the services in a vertical stack. Now, we can do that today, right? I mean, that's something that we can do. So I want to give you some action items, and, you know, and then in a few minutes I'll open it up to discussion and see if people have other ideas from the room that they want to throw out there. But here would be some action items. So first, explore solutions that allow you to own your own data. Don't expect that the cloud has any, you know, when you sign that end user license agreement, even if you check, you know, even if you read it closely, the reality is the odds are that they're not guaranteeing you that they have any obligation to make your data any safer than they can, and there's very little recourse for you if that data goes away or is misused. So make sure that you control your own data. Spread the love. use a variety of services. You know, I understand we're all busy, and I understand that it's really tempting to say, oh, okay, I'll just have everything be verticalized in front of one company or one stack or one device. And I would just say, with all due respect to our friends at these companies, and I work with all of them, by the way, they all need to understand that as customers, we want them to play nice together. And we want our data to be our data, and we don't want it to be owned by third parties. And that's something that we can really begin. I mean, that's a movement we can start. Third, ask for interoperability. Keep asking for it. Ask for it every day. Embrace what I call, you know, a multicultural web. You know, take a step back and look at your data storage habits. And if at the end of the day your data storage habits are that you've, you know, doubled down or tripled down on one company or one service or one cloud, think about whether or not that seems healthy. Pay attention to the government and its attempt to restrict or limit the open web. And by that I mean, you know, everything from what's going on with access to broadband. There's a whole long list of things that are going on at the federal level. And it's not that I believe the government has ever any agenda to close the web. I don't. I just think institutions tend to operate to protect their own interests. And it's certainly easier for the government to deal with the web if it has a handful of servers rather than this, you know, whack-a-mole problem of things keep hopping around. And so, you know, begin to look at patterns where the web is less free and make sure that you're not okay with that. And then last but not least, remember that the web is only as free as you demand for it to be. So with that, I want to go back to our panel. By the way, it's not like I knew exactly what the table was going to look like, but I think I did a pretty good job, right? But you even got the little banner back there. I wanted to let each of our virtual panelists in the Geek Course have one last word, and then we'll wrap things up in a little bit.
There have been some big... I suppose what's unsettling is that in the United States, where the web is becoming a huge amount of people's lives, it's becoming part of the way people determine who to vote. It's how they determine whether or not they have a disease before even they go to the doctor. It's becoming... For example, if you're a teenager and you're just not sure really what it means to be gay, or you're not sure what it means to have a sexually transmitted disease, the first place you go is the web. You want to be able to go there in privacy, and you want to be able to go to any website you want. You don't want to go to one which is politically biased or commercially biased to sell you a particular drug.
Tim? You know, there are levels of lock-in, and it doesn't always matter. You know, so for example, if you think about the free software movement, they never went after Intel, yet Intel was just as much of a monopolist as Microsoft. And it's really important to realize that in an ecosystem, there are these dominant predators, and there's room for, you know, other kinds of organisms. And I think we need to think about technology the same way. It doesn't have to all be open.
And then last,
I think when you shut something down here, it'll explode somewhere else. It's information, I think, as Kevin Kelly said, wants to be free.
So I think that's pretty optimistic. I mean, for three smart guys who I think probably in their DNA could be pessimistic, I think the fact that, you know, fundamentally the thesis is, you know, we need to pay attention, but there is some sense that things may close down one place and they'll open somewhere else. So I thought I would go ahead and just give you my thesis, having spent now, you know, the better part of the last couple of months looking at this. I'm absolutely sure that digital overload isn't going away. I think anybody that tells you that the solution is to consume more of the web or limit the way people are able to publish or limit the tools that people are able to have access to just isn't paying attention to the fundamentals of Moore's Law and whatever law we don't yet have a name for, which is content explosion. So I'm not a fan of doing anything with digital overload other than embracing it. And, you know, I don't think we should fight the cloud. I think we should own it. I think we should take responsibility for it. I think we should pay attention to it. I think we should understand that if we ignore it, it will evolve into being something. And if we request that it, and we demand that it treat us in a certain way, collectively, if SOPA and PIPA taught us anything, it's that as a group, we have a lot of power. So That brings us to the thesis of the talk. Is the cloud Skynet? And I hope I've taken you on a little bit of a journey through that question. And the decision that I came to, and that I hope you'll agree with, is it's only if we allow it to be. Thank you very much. So we have a couple of minutes, and we have smart people in the room. So if we can grab a mic, and people want to raise their hand. And I'm going to facilitate a conversation. I don't claim to be an expert on all of this. So, you know, if you have, right here.
As a company that may be trying to be a bastion of openness and but also digital content storage, is there a way? Is there, as Tim Berners-Lee said, it doesn't have to be open. Is there a way for corporations, maybe not corporations, but you know, startups, to present themselves as an open way of storing their digital content online? I guess maybe a good way to ask this is, if you were looking for a company to entrust your digital information with, what would you look for in that company or anybody else in the audience that might have some?
So here's my answer, and it's a personal answer. You all have to do what you have to do. I have 14 terabytes of storage in my living room. Now, that doesn't mean I don't use all these services. It doesn't mean that I'm not, you know, my photographs aren't on Facebook and I'm not sharing them on Flickr. And I absolutely believe in the sharing ecosystem. And I trust Yahoo to store my pictures on Flickr, and I trust Facebook to share my pictures on Facebook. But the original copies, I store on my server. And the reason I do that is because at the end of the day, you know, they're companies. And again, back to, you know, what we learned from Juan Enriquez, companies go away. History says companies go away, right? I mean, so I think the answer is, you know, what I would say, and it's tricky, right? Because, you know, everyone who's running an internet startup, lock-in is awesome, right? But make sure that what you're locking people into is a service that you're providing that doesn't put them at risk. Because the reality is, you know, shit happens.
If I could add to that, I guess that's part of my question, though, is it possible for a company to have sort of a altruistic sort of outlook and to convince customers and to not actually want to lock them in, to want it to be open, but to still, you know, provide that service? I think there's a lot of value in having a startup that, you know, can write the software to make this possible.
So I think that's an awesome question. And I think that at the end of the day, you know, I'll give you an example. So my wife says to me the other day, I really wish that we could pay for a calendar program rather than have a free one. I think it would be worth it for me to own that data on our family calendar, and I'd rather pay $10 a month. And I thought, boy, I'm not sure there is such a thing. Well, I assume that she's not the only customer in the world that thinks that. So maybe the answer, I mean, think about it. It wasn't that long ago that the thesis of the web was everything had to be free. Nobody was going to pay for anything. And now we routinely pay for storage, and we pay for servers, and we pay for, you know, software. So maybe the answer is that increasingly we build businesses by offering a service and say, listen, we don't need as much access to your privacy, but we do need you to pay us so we can stay in business. Other questions?
I'll continue on his for just 1 second. There are companies that are altruistic, and then there are companies that want to lock you in. An example of altruistic is Google. Inside of Google, there is the DLF, the Data Liberation Front, that's dataliberationfront.org, a group inside of Google that's determined to give you every piece of data you own in Google so you can download it. They're working on Google Plus, and they have just finished Gmail, so you can now get all your Gmail and all your attachments. In my case, that was very, very close to 20 gigabytes. But it is possible. Then again, you'll never see this from Apple. You know, you'll probably never ever see it from Yahoo in any real way. That's why companies like Bulker exist. So is there an opportunity? Yes. Is it profitable? Hell yes.
By the way, I love that hell yes was the answer. All right, we have time for a couple more. Way in back.
So I guess I'm wondering, and maybe there's a temperature we can take in the room, but there's different mental models of what facet of your identity, of what persona you're showing to the world. And we naturally I think in large part, like, we solve this problem as individuals every day. Like, each one of these companies can tell us that we should store all their data in there. But we, like, reject that on its face. Like, we don't put the same data in LinkedIn as we put on Facebook. Like, it's obvious. The reasons that we use these services are different. And so I guess I'm just wondering, like, I mean, I get the concern, but I'm just wondering, like, since we're all people and, like, people are social creatures and we present different facets of ourselves to people, like, we do this all, you know, we're in a professional context here, we're going to do it for the next 4 days, except for at, like, 2 a.m. So, like, what's the line there? Like, are we solving this problem ourselves already?
So I disagree with only one thing that you said. So I love LinkedIn as a business connecting tool and I love Facebook as social, but increasingly LinkedIn seems to be sucking in all my information and things that I put on Twitter or Facebook show up on LinkedIn, and I'm currently finding it harder to have different versions of my digital story that I can tell to different communities. So if LinkedIn asked me, I would say, listen, I'd be happier using you if you would define yourself as a business tool. And so, again, it's back to us as customers. As long as the goal for each of these companies is to try and win some global arms race to own all the data in every vertical, then they're going to continue to eat each other's lunch. My hope is that over time, that's not what happens, and they actually get good at doing their individual jobs. So one more question. Okay, so two asks from you. You get to rate this session, so please, if you are happy, tell the folks at South By that you enjoyed it. My Twitter handle is @magnify. I'd love you to follow me and send comments to me and continue this conversation. And then last but not least, shameless plug, this is my book. I'm going to be outside signing books. Would love to meet some of you. Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate the time.